your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. All comments, views, and opinions expressed are solely those of the host, guest, and callers. In the next hour, Dr. Rosenthal and her guests cover both the common and the not-so-common health issues you want and need to know. Get your pencils ready. Here's your host, Dr. Sarah Rosenthal.
Hello, welcome to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, the program that reminds anyone coping with health problems, we are not alone. The goal of this program is to discuss both common and not-so-common health issues with the experts who really know what they're talking about. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. I have a long career as a medical journalist and am the author of over 30 consumer health books. I have a Ph.D. in medical ethics and medical sociology and direct the program for bioethics and patients' rights at the University of Kentucky. Today, we are devoting our show to the subject of infertility and what I call the fertility industry. A lot of my opinions and guidance on this topic can be found in my book, The Fertility Sourcebook, 3rd edition, available on Amazon. Today, I've invited Dr. Elena Christofides, an endocrinologist in private practice in Columbus, Ohio, to have a discussion with me on this topic. Dr. Christofides is board certified in endocrinology and internal medicine. She received both her undergraduate and medical degrees from The Ohio State University. She completed her internal medicine residency at Mount Carmel West and her fellowship training in endocrinology and metabolism at Louisiana State University Medical Center. Dr. Christofides is also vice president of the Ohio Valley chapter of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. Dr. Christofides has an interest in female hormone issues and sees many women struggling with infertility and men and the workup process. Dr. Christofides, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
I guess we were just chatting before we went on air, but one of the let's start with defining the difference between an endocrinologist and the role of an endocrinologist in infertility treatments and workups, and the role of the reproductive endocrinologist.
Well, thank you for pointing this out. This is definitely something that confuses patients often, and it mostly stems from simply a technical terminology difference. Endocrinology is basically the medicine related to diabetes, hormone therapies, metabolism, and it is fundamentally a subspecialty of the Department of Internal Medicine or a subspecialty of general medicine. So we are, by training, medical doctors or internists who have then further gone on to develop specializations in the things I've mentioned previously, whereas a reproductive endocrinologist is a subspecialty of the obstetric and gynecology division, which is fundamentally a surgical specialty. So they would do their main training as OBGYNs and then move on to doing the subspecialization in reproductive techniques and infertility, and they are called reproductive endocrinologists. So two very fundamentally different specialties that have a lot of overlap, actually.
That's so basically then when you're talking about infertility treatments, it's, one is really dealing more with the hormonal aspects and the other is dealing more with the procedural aspects.
Yes, that's a good way to think about it. We would deal with all the hormonal evaluation and we could do the hormonal manipulation, and the reproductive endocrinologists certainly use hormones to, obviously they have to use hormone manipulation during their surgical techniques and procedures. So I divide it up for my patients as the laboratory evaluation and manipulation of their hormones versus the surgical manipulation of their hormones, which sort of defines it for patients. It's not exactly clear-cut that way, but it's very easy for patients to understand the differences in that regard then.
One of the things that we were also chatting about is, I guess what my I'll just admit this here, my main beef with the term infertility epidemic is that I don't know if we're having an epidemic. I think that it's really that women are delaying childbirth for a variety of sociological reasons. And I wanted to sort of talk about what are the realistic stats on this, realistic statistics on the ages, the optimal ages for getting pregnant.
Yes, I have to agree with you. I think that epidemic is definitely not the term. I completely agree with you that I believe it is a sociologic issue in terms of what we are demanding of our female population. And the realistic optimum time for pregnancy is indeed in the late teen and early 20s time frame, which is obviously not socially acceptable anymore. But definitely from about 16, 17 on to mid-20s, 25, 26 is really the optimum time.
So this is essentially creating a crisis in fertility for women who are delaying for very necessary reasons, but it's not necessarily an infertility epidemic for physical reasons.
No, absolutely. I mean, the physical infertility part of it is simply because we have not been able to turn back the clock yet on the natural aging of the ovary in the woman's body. You know, one would think that we might be able to by now, given all the advances we've made in other medical areas, but this is not one of them. And it certainly is a little, you know, strange that men can produce children up until the time they die and women cannot.
Except they might be too old to pick them up.
They don't have to pick them up to make them.
Yeah, it's definitely unfair. Unfair biology.
It is very unfair biology. And since we cannot and have not found a way yet to manipulate that in women, we are still bound by our biological clocks in a way that is not represented in the other sex. And so, you know, we've created the problem because it is no longer socially acceptable to marry at the age of 13 or 14 when menses begin and begin producing children shortly thereafter. So, because, you know, women and the sociology of our atmosphere and our lifestyle here in the North American continent is one of career-mindedness and preservation of your independence prior to getting married and having children and a family, because of the perceived dependence that creates on you as a woman and your inability to function in dual roles, which we both know to be not really true, but certainly that is the perception and that is the trend.
And, you know, I mean, I often say that, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers were just pregnant teenagers that got married.
Yeah. I know that to be the case of several of my relatives, yes.
That's how they had such large families. So,
yep.
I'm looking at a chart here that actually is in my book, and I'd like to just go through these ages, and I'll tell you what's on my chart, and you can tell me what needs to be updated, because this was actually put out in the International Journal of Fertility circa 1988. So I have here that the likelihood of getting pregnant between the age of 20 to 24 is 100%, and the likelihood of infertility is 3%. So that would still be correct?
Yeah, I think that's still correct. And I haven't seen any statistics that change that yet.
25 to 29, it's 94% in terms of the likelihood of getting pregnant. Once you get to age 30, 30 to 34, you have an 86% chance of getting pregnant. But where the problem is I think when we get into the 35 to 39 slot, I've got a 70% chance of getting pregnant, but a 15% likelihood of infertility, which is actually quite large, and then 40 to 44, you only have a 36% chance of getting pregnant, and a 32% likelihood of infertility, and 45 to 49, obviously, it goes down even further to only 5% likelihood of getting pregnant.
Right.
And so I would imagine that the women that you see in their late 30s to maybe mid 40s are wondering what to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that people are relatively aware that once you hit 40, your chances of getting pregnant under normal circumstances of intercourse are much diminished. And I think people are fairly aware of that. What I don't think people are aware of is the numbers that drop off at the age of 30 and then 35. Since I am on the lower half side of the 35 to 40 mark, I'm on the declining side of that myself. It's really interesting to me to see the changes that happen in your system, and I don't think women are quite aware, but I think a 70% chance of getting pregnant is pretty low for someone I would consider to be rather healthy. You know, let's take a typical 35 or 36-year-old. So I think that this represents a variety of hormonal issues that are occurring at this time frame, and I just think women underappreciate the aging of their bodies and think that mentally they feel good and young, and therefore they hormonally are good and young, and that's not the case.
And I guess is it fair to say too, you know, it's also my perception that the very existence of fertility treatments gives women almost a false sense of security that they can delay this.
Biological
age.
That is absolutely true. I routinely see that in my practice, and even in my own family members, where I've had people tell me when they come in, let's say they come into my practice in their mid-20s, and I say, you know, you need to consider the fact that if you're planning on having children based on your hormonal situation that's occurring, you may not have that luxury by the time you're in your 30s, and so you need to take precautions or take into consideration what things you may need to in order to prepare for that eventuality. And I routinely get the response back that, yes, but with our fertility treatments being so good and being what they are today, you know, if it's a problem, I'll just have fertility treatments.
Yeah. I'll freeze my eggs and save them in a dish, but not a good dish.
Well, you know, the thing that always astounds me is I tell them that at that point, well, then you better start saving, since every month it's going to cost you roughly $10,000 for fertility treatments, and there's only a 36% chance you'll get pregnant with each cycle. That's a lot of money. I said, you're better off of saving for retirement to be in a really good retirement home, so that, because you won't, you know, aren't going to have the money then if you don't do that.
So at one point, when I looked into these statistics, at one point, I guess in the 80s and 90s, it was a 13% chance of success in one cycle. So it's actually gone up from 13.
Yeah, it has gone up.
That's a bit of an improvement.
It is an improvement, and that is probably the only representation that we have that our medicine, medical technology has advanced. We used to do what people, I think, used to call in vitro fertilization, which was basically mixing the sperm and the egg in a dish and injecting into the uterus and hoping for the best. Whereas we've moved far, far beyond that now. And so we have had an improvement in success per cycle, but of course the cost and the drama and trauma, literally in both senses, to the woman have also dramatically increased.
Which hopefully we'll get into in the next segment. With the remaining time in this segment, what I wanted to also, and we may have to go into it later, but what are some of the accepted causes of infertility in otherwise healthy people? Things like, you know, STDs, or things like, are there environmental factors that we hear a lot about, or, you know, sort of the effects of estrogenic contamination in the environment, those kinds of things?
The most accepted forms of infertility are basically from a male factor side, because those are the easiest ones. genetic disorders like cystic fibrosis and chromosomal abnormalities, such as somebody who has Klinefelter's, which is one example of a genetic abnormality because you are not quite XY, and then azoospermia, which is usually considered to be some sort of environmental cause of suddenly loss of sperm production in a normal, healthy male with normal testosterone. On the female side of things, it's a very, very variable. The accepted causes are things that are very common, like polycystic ovarian syndrome, which affects 26%. You hear statistics of anywhere from 17 to 26% of the childbearing population. Certainly STDs, which is, I heard, 1 in 3 college students now will have an STD by the time they graduate, which to me was an absolutely staggering number of people.
Yeah.
Considering it was certainly not that way when I went to college. And those are the two most common causes of infertility. And then endometriosis is rapidly gaining notoriety as a cause of infertility because of the scarring that occurs around the female organs in that situation. So those are the main ones that take up the vast majority of the causes. And there's quite a few, and you certainly mentioned some that are not controversial, but less so involving infertility, and others that are more controversial, such as estrogenic compound exposure in the environment, which is actually one of my pet issues and one that my husband actually studied during his research years. So,
because there is research saying that there's a lot of that might be why we're seeing larger increases. We'll talk about that after the break. We're going to have to take a break now. My guest is Ohio-based Dr. Elena Christofides, who is a hormone specialist, talking with me today about infertility. For more information on infertility, we suggest starting with my book, The Fertility Source Book, now in its third edition, available on Amazon, which is one of the few consumer books to raise the social and ethical questions surrounding fertility treatments. When we come back, we'll talk more about causes of infertility, female and male factor infertility. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit YourHealthPress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Stay mentally, physically, and emotionally fit with Younger Every Day. Hosted by Dr. Bob Payson. Broadcast every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Younger Every Day will offer you alternative solutions for a variety of health issues, all backed by clinical, scientific, and medical data. Dr. Payson and other expert guests will inform and inspire people of all ages to look and feel better. Younger Every Day. Think clear. Feel strong. Grow Younger with Dr. Bob Payson, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell that saves from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote, and then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found a small patch of plastic on my right shoulder.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
Your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of the fertility industry with Ohio-based hormone specialist Dr. Elena Christofides. We left off in the last segment talking about the causes of infertility, one of them mainly being the social cause of delayed child rearing necessary reasons, particularly if you're a woman. And we're also talking about some of the environmental and lifestyle causes as well as genetic causes. Let's get into discussing more sort of female and male factor infertility. What are the actual, as opposed to what causes the infertility, what are the most common, reasons for not getting pregnant?
Well, you'd be surprised, Sarah, at how many people are misinformed as to exactly how you're supposed to do it and when you're supposed to do it. It always amazes me to see that. But basically, when you look at that, you want to evaluate the couple and ask some very detailed questions about their private life in that way. And the evaluation is really going to be looking at discerning where some of those problems might be if they have any of those. And then from the male side of things, it's really going to be some habits, some sexual history, and actually both of those, male and female sides, habits, sexual history, physical exam. Actually, the physical exam portion, which is basically where the doctor examines the patient and does a series of blood tests to determine their overall health, is probably the most important way of just getting some early identifiers out there to sort through, you know, which direction they should look.
What are some of the habits of infertile people?
Yeah.
What are the bad habits that teenagers
hear with this? Men, for instance, who, this is a big one that comes up all the time, we hear about, and it's probably not as important as we used to think it was, but men who wear tight underwear as opposed to boxers. Men who are overweight and do not exercise very much. Actually, obesity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, obesity for the men, which I would consider a habit, not a disease necessarily, given I realize that that politically is a charged statement, but truly being obese is a habit and it's a lifestyle choice that actually affects infertility in men much more than I think they appreciate.
Why does it, what's going on there? Why does that affect it?
Well, the testicles are held below the, or outside the body for a reason. They need to be several degrees cooler than the body in order to have efficient production of sperm. So when you have an obese male who has perhaps not as much room between their legs, or they have a lot of pannus, which is the belly fat, I guess is the best way to put it, that overhangs the genital region, the testicles end up getting trapped between the body parts and, in fact, end up overheating. Because
wow.
That area of the body is actually quite warm compared to the extremities, like the arms and the legs.
How many men do you think realize this?
None of them.
Wow.
I really don't think I've ever come across a man who realized that his obesity was the cause of the problem. And so the testicles end up getting overheated, and so then sperm production shuts down because it's not, you know, it's not appropriate. The body can't handle that. And so you can simulate the same thing by wearing very tight underwear that are very hugging to the body as opposed to boxers. And this is where the whole boxers versus briefs issue came into play. But I think the boxer brief issue is much less important than obesity, given the degree of obesity in this country now.
And the fact that it's just so much on the rise. I have heard from experts that girth on males can interfere just with intercourse in general and positioning.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you got to get into proper position, and you've got to have all the parts in close proximity in order to be able to get them into proper position. Trying to avoid being crude on your radio show there, Sarah. But certainly there's the actual physicality of getting an obese person into the right position, not to mention the temperature differences in that region. And then you couple that with a woman who perhaps has very long issues, you know, not to mention, you know, the habits. Okay, so habits in a woman would be obesity as well, and also habits would be perhaps if she's had a series of unprotected intercourse partners and has gotten an STD, she might have some scarring on her fallopian tubes that prevent the egg from traveling down to meet the sperm, and so there's a common habit issue. And other habits such as douching. Believe it or not, douching has been really, really frowned upon and tried to be eradicated by the American College of Gynecology for some time because of the abnormal milieu is one way we describe it, but basically abnormal pH, abnormal flow of fluids, and just irritation in that area can also contribute to problems.
Wow, so those are not necessarily well-known issues. What about things like alcohol, smoking, a lot of those?
Well, those habits are less well understood in terms of their interplay with fertility. I mean, obviously I was talking very narrowly about habits that would affect directly the actual chances of getting pregnant, but smoking and alcohol are interesting because in spite of the fact that we have many, many people who continue to smoke heavily and drink heavily, we do not see the infertility issues one would expect. For some reason, the body is able to overcome some of that, those unhealthy habits. And I think it's probably because, physically speaking, those have very little impact on the hormonal system, and also very little impact on the actual mechanics of intercourse.
I see.
So they probably have very little influence, although we'd love it to be more influential, but it's really not.
Well, I guess alcohol can also be considered something that people, and I mean, it may help the process.
Well, yes, as a
issues.
Yeah, I was going to say more in the line of getting an STD, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of the female workup and the male workup, it sounds like it would seem clear that it's much easier to do a male workup first if there's a problem, or does it not?
Actually, we tend to do them simultaneously because a third of the time it's a male factor, a third of the time it's a female factor, and the other third of the time it's a combination of both and or unknown.
I see.
So it's really much more commonly a male factor than people believe. I think everyone wants to blame it on the woman because after all, the men, you know, they see that they're able to perform the mechanics of such, and therefore they believe themselves to be completely functional when you don't have to be able to do the mechanics to be able to produce, or vice versa. So
What goes into in a male workup? And let's say you're doing, I guess it starts with a semen analysis.
Yeah, we generally for the male side of things, we do a physical exam to eliminate physical damage and abnormalities directly at the testicle level, like a varicocele or a hernia or masses or other things that might be physically impeding the process. And then we do a semen analysis, and if the semen analysis comes back highly abnormal, we do sometimes perform a chromosomal test because in that situation we would look for such as cystic fibrosis or Klinefelter's or other abnormalities that would interfere with normal sperm production. And we also would do a hormonal analysis. And under the hormonal analysis, we would be looking for adequate testosterone levels, adequate, sugar, well, actually normal electrolytes, meaning we don't want them to be diabetic, we don't want them to have too much of other hormones that suppress testosterone production. There are several hormones that will do that, such as if the patient has too much estrogen, because in men, estrogen shuts down testosterone production, and if they have other hormone levels like prolactin is another one very commonly that will shut down testosterone production as well as semen production. So the male evaluation tends to be a little bit easier because you're doing basically blood work, semen analysis, and then a physical exam.
I see, and it's the female, the dreaded female workup, where there are a number of invasive tests that are involved.
Yes, the men always complain about the semen analysis, but it's the women who have to undergo all the poking and prodding.
Kenya, before we go to our next break, could you briefly describe what's involved in a female workup?
Yeah, basically, at its very basic issue is the same. You're doing a physical exam. Externally, you're doing blood work to make sure that everything is normal in that regard. And then you go one step further. If the woman is cycling monthly, you don't need to do such a large hormonal workup, but you do need to do basal body temperature testing to make sure that the woman is actually ovulating, and that can coincide with the hormonal blood work. And if the woman is actually ovulating, then the invasive tests then begin. The invasive tests are things like laparoscopic surgery to look for endometriosis and hysterosalpingogram, which is where they inject dye into the uterus and the fallopian tubes to see if they are open and actually normal in size and function. And so basically much more involved than just the basic blood work.
We're going to have to take another break. My guest is Ohio-based Dr. Elena Christofides, who is a hormone specialist, talking with me today about infertility. For more information on infertility, we suggest starting with my book, The Fertility Sourcebook, now in its third edition, available on Amazon, which is one of the few consumer books to raise the social and ethical questions surrounding fertility treatments. When we come back, we'll talk more about treatment options and success rates, and perhaps donated reproductive materials. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. For further information, visit me online at sarahhealth.com. All shows are archived on our site as well as at Voice America Health and Wellness Network at voiceamerica.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your health, your network. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit yourhealthpress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Women, do you feel that you're too old to be active, too old to be beautiful, too old to have fun, or too old to be fabulous? Well, if that's what you think, then there's good news for you. You're wrong. Tune in to Voice America every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for Aging Outside the Box, Fabulous Women Over 50 with Shirley Mitchell. Aging Outside the Box is a fabulous, fun program that gives you every reason to feel greater than you ever have. Host Shirley Mitchell and O.E. Cruiser Small will cover phenomenal topics such as women's issues, health, diet, exercise, nutrition, faith, travel, and many other concerns for women of all ages. Feel young, feel smart, and feel fabulous by tuning in to Aging Outside the Box. Fabulous Women Over 50 with Shirley Mitchell every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, right here on VoiceAmerica.com.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah. Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
Hello, we are back. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of the fertility industry and treatments with Ohio-based hormone specialist Dr. Elena Christofides. Welcome back. What I wanted to talk about in this segment is we were talking on the break, the treatments for infertility, and I'm happy to hear that they're getting easy. We're limiting a number of unsuccessful treatments.
Yeah, I do think that the industry has gotten smart, that women can only stand the drama for so long, so they've really honed in on the practices that have the greatest chance of success. So those are basically IUI, which is intrauterine insemination, and IVF, which is in vitro fertilization for the women. And then basically for the men, either you have them ejaculate and you wash their sperm and collect it to use in these procedures, or you have to do a testicular biopsy to harvest sperm if they don't have any.
I see. Okay. So in other words, with a testicular biopsy, the money's in the bank, but you can't withdraw it, so you have to go in and get it.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have to go in and get it and harvest the sperm and coddle them along till they're at a decent stage where you could use them. And in those patients, they typically would perform ICSI, which is a version of IVF. And ICSI stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where basically they take an individual sperm, inject it into the egg, rather than incubate sperm and egg together, allowing natural fertilization, and then injecting the fertilized embryo into the woman's uterus. So because those patients are considered to be much lower chances of actually achieving a fertilized embryo.
Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask you about ICSI is I think I'm one of the few bioethicists who's a member of the Endocrine Society, and it comes up every year where there's usually a few things regarding infertility treatments and sort of the ethics of. And it's my understanding that with ICSI, there's a lot of ethical issues because we're wondering if we're monkeying around with nature to such a degree that we're actually injecting bad sperm, sperm that would never have made it on their own.
Oh, yeah, now, there's a can of worms we just opened. Certainly from an endocrinology standpoint, obviously not being, I'm not the reproductive endocrinologist sitting there saying that you need to do this.
Procedure.
Yeah, doing the procedure and then taking the money and giving the woman and the husband a healthy baby. I agree in the sense that this is a very contentious issue, and it does bother me in some ways that we have a situation where there's something wrong and we're trying our hardest to overcome something that's wrong. And I think we do not have enough time under our belts to see if there's any greater incidence of trouble or damage to these children that are born by this procedure, because it's not been around for very long. So these kids have not grown up and realized full potential as adults yet. So I would like to reserve judgment as to whether this is ethically sound or not until we know what's going to be the outcome of these children. And if all of them turn out to be completely healthy, happy adults who have no issues other than the basic background population issues that we always see, I'm not asking for them to be perfect, I think that everyone would be a lot more comfortable with this option and feel less odd about monkeying around with nature.
So far, ICSI pregnancies progress as other pregnancies. There's not been any. They don't have a lower success rate than other types of fertility or enhanced reproductive techniques.
No, they seem to be exactly. They seem to be indistinguishable from the others.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Basically, so far,
too early to tell. We have to see what happens, and that's. And you were also let's talk a little bit about the success rates with IVF and IUI, and so they're all at about 36%.
No, they're between 20 and 36%, 23 and 36
per cycle.
Per cycle.
And how much does a cycle cost?
There's a huge discrepancy. Intrauterine insemination is basically where the man ejaculates into a cup, basically, of some sort, and the clinic will wash the sperm to prepare it for transit, and then they'll inject the sperm into the woman's uterus, and she's undergone an enhanced cycle where she's been stimulated to overproduce eggs. And so they'll simply, I like to call this the turkey baster method, basically, is they're using the turkey baster method to get the sperm into the uterus and then hope that they meet the eggs and have fun and have a party, and then the woman ends up pregnant. These cost very little compared to IVF, and they're anywhere from $100 to $300 per cycle.
Oh, that's not so bad.
No, because basically the woman is paying for the drugs. It's basically Clomid is what we use, which is clomiphene citrate, and it's not an expensive medication, and you take it for 5 to 10 days at the beginning of your cycle to prep your body. Then you have one injection of HCG to induce the eggs to be released at an exact time, so that you're releasing eggs at the time that the reproductive endocrinologist wants you to, and they are at that moment, they've washed the sperm, they're injecting the sperm. And so the cost is really the labor involved in rinsing the semen, getting the sperm, and then doing the whole turkey baster thing at that moment in the clinic, and then it's a wait and see. So there's very little involved in that, actually. Because you're assuming that really the egg and the sperm are fine, and they just haven't met under the proper circumstances.
it's like a dating service.
It is a dating service, and you're just trying to introduce them in the proper setting. You know, make it a little bit less intimidating for both of them.
But it's the IVF that's more expensive.
IVF is, I think, the lowest price I've ever seen quoted is about $7,000 to $8,000 a month, which to me is a little on the low side. I've seen it as high as $12,000 and $15,000.
So we're looking at roughly 20 to 30 percent success rates per cycle.
So it takes three cycles.
Three cycles, and I imagine that there are couples that just never work.
Yeah, there are plenty of couples that go through multiple cycles of IVF and never get pregnant, mostly because they have unknown factors as to the cause of their infertility, and those are sometimes the hardest to deal with because you don't have any answers. you don't know why they're infertile, you don't know why the IVF isn't taking. We can postulate and theorize all we want, but the bottom line is that that's why it's not 100% after three cycles, because there's a small percentage of women who do not keep a pregnancy after three cycles, but the generally accepted statistics are 85 to 95% success after three cycles.
Okay, so that's a little bit more optimistic. So couples have to plan, if they're going to have IVF, to have about $30,000 in the bank before they, and what about insurance coverage for this?
The insurance, it's very variable. Insurance coverage is very interesting. It tends to be very religiously based. And what I mean by that is insurance companies that are institution based, such as the hospital that I work at is a Catholic hospital, and the insurance plan is governed. It's an employee health plan, and it is owned by the Catholic organization that governs our hospital as well as many others, and they actually cover infertility treatment because it is their mandate that women would be reproductively active and have children. So the consequence is they don't pay for birth control, and they don't pay for vasectomies, and they don't pay for tubal ligations, and they don't pay for abortions, but they'll pay for in vitro. Now, the coverage for in vitro is variable. That's the one extreme. The other extreme is, of course, no payment, which is really the norm. It is the exception that some coverage is there. And the coverage will vary anywhere from the medication coverage, which is about $3,000 to $5,000 of the cost, and then there's the procedural cost, which is basically the harvesting of the semen, the harvesting of the eggs, the technology involved and the mechanics involved in getting an embryo, holding onto an embryo, watching it develop, and then reimplanting it in the female. That's really what you would consider the labor cost involved, and so the insurance plans do discriminate. So the norm is that there's no coverage. The exception is that it's all covered, and somewhere in between are those plans who cover some of the medicine, but none of the labor, none of the medicine, some of the labor, and vice versa.
Now, I guess all of this, with these success rates, I guess what we also have to talk about is that would they vary if you're using donated gametes or donated reproductive materials, or would they even improve if you're getting donated eggs, for example, from a younger woman?
No, they actually, the donation doesn't, the fact that it's donated doesn't change the success rate of the procedures overall, but what does change is the success rate of having an implantable embryo that is useful based on the age of the female that donated or the age of the egg, so that if you're using donated eggs from a 40-year-old female, they will have a less chance of developing into a useful embryo to implant versus the donated egg from a 20-year-old.
I see.
But the actual procedure itself is about the same success rate because they don't implant it until the embryo reaches a particular stage, and if it reaches a particular stage, it is assumed that it is a useful and good embryo.
Now, back in the days before more stringent regulation, it used to be that a success rate, we're going to have to talk about this in a minute, we're going to take a break again. My guest is Ohio-based Dr. Elena Christofides, who is a hormone specialist, talking with me today about infertility. For more information on infertility, we suggest starting with my book, The Fertility Source Book, now in its third edition, available on Amazon. For further information, visit me online at sarahhealth.com. All shows are archived on our site, as well as at Voice America Health and Wellness Network at voiceamerica.com. When we come back, we'll talk more about ethics and fertility treatment, as well as more about reproductive materials that are donated. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Steps to a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special
special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit YourHealthPress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Growing up in America explores the challenges, risks, benefits, and differences this generation of children face each day. Hosted by veteran pediatric emergency physician and father of four, Dr. Charles Muzica, this show is for parents, teens, and children. It crosses each generation. By exploring the unique aspects of matriculation within this current generation, we hope to find answers and ways of optimizing this experience for today's generation. Growing Up in America with Dr. Charles Muzica broadcasts each Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure.
There's this girl I kind of like.
Say no more.
You just have to impress her.
Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
You know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, There you go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt U.S. Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Are you tired of being tired? Are you sick of sitting around while life passes you by? You can get back on track by tuning in to Voice America Health and Wellness every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Time. For Attracting Abundance, the energy of success with Carol Look. Attracting Abundance is the program that empowers you to finally break through your limiting beliefs and blocks and shows you how to succeed in all areas of your life, from improved financial abundance, health and weight problems, as well as your relationships. Don't wait another week to be joyful. Listen to Attracting Abundance, the energy of success with Carol Look, this Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Time, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of the fertility industry with Ohio-based hormone specialist Dr. Elena Christofides. Where we left off before the break was talking a little bit about treatment options, the now more improved success rates, and donated reproductive materials. And I wanted to get into the discussion on the egg market. Because there's huge discrepancies apparently between what women actually get paid for egg donation, and is this considered coercement, and are they aware of what they're actually donating? So let's get into that a little bit.
Yes, when I was in medical school, I was very interested at the time because you're very poor and you've got a lot of loans, and medical school costs a lot of money. I went to a cheap school, I mean, by comparison, and I still owed $25,000 a year in terms of loans just to, you know, make it by, and that was basically living off $800 a month stipend to pay rent and food and car and bills and gas and books and all the sundry items that you need to live. And that was off for two people, actually, for me and my husband. So, you know, money is tight. And when I was in medical school, there were flyers everywhere and saying, basically, you know, we'll pay you for your eggs and, you know, donate eggs and so on. And the inducement in the population of patients and female population is definitely skewed towards women who are in very in high-paying and highly intellectual fields, or so what's perceived by those who are requesting this. So the payments can be upwards of $5,000 to $10,000 per cycle in terms of harvesting, because they can harvest anywhere from 10 to 20 eggs per cycle in a young, healthy woman. And the interesting thing is, when I spoke to my friends and colleagues at Ivy League institutions, their inducement was much greater than ours. They were offered much more money, on the order of two to five times as much as we were, for the same, basically same genetic material, which is just an egg. But clearly there's a valuation difference between whether you got into Harvard versus whether you went to your local community college.
that's what's really fascinating about this, because obviously it raises some very, I think some pretty serious justice questions. I know that from the feminist ethics side of things, you know, nobody can really agree what, you know, what is a good price for an egg, and what would be, should donation be paid? Should it be true donation for altruistic reasons? I don't think that this has been worked out at all, and nobody's got really any clear answers on this. What are some of the trends that you're seeing with donations?
Well, you know, certainly, like you said,
attitudes and those kinds of things.
I mean, the attitude is basically how much value do you place on a human life? I mean, certainly, no one would argue that an egg from a woman is life. It's not yet, because it's not even. I mean, it's just not connected with the sperm yet at all. But the point is that how much are you placing a value on that? And that value judgment is what's driving a lot of the trends in egg donation away from anonymous donors actually to genetically related donors. Because I think women and society at large is having a hard time with saying that your genes are more valuable than somebody else's genes, because it's become basically a Chinese menu option. I'd like one from column A, one from column B, one from column C. You know, I would like blonde hair, brown eyes, and a Harvard grad with special skills in music. It's almost like a mail order child. And I think that we are having a great deal of difficulty reconciling that with what the basic premise of all this is to give a man and a woman a child of their own, which, when under normal circumstances, doesn't come with any preconceived notions of what you're going to get.
I mean, this also creates, I mean, not to mention the legal issues, I mean, this also creates, you know, family law problems of nightmares.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can have, I mean, I've heard of stories where, of cases where, you know, mom borrows some eggs from, you know, her teenage daughter because she's in her second or third marriage and wants to get pregnant again. So, you know, mom might be, you know, in her late 40s, and, you know, there's the teenage daughter and who becomes the biological mother of would be her sibling.
Right.
Yeah.
absolutely.
When she calls her sibling, she is really her daughter.
Right. So the mother's giving birth to her granddaughter.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. These are just very strange stories.
Well, and you're right. The legal cases at the moment are full of these. There's a lot of cases that are being brought out from state to state, and so far they haven't reached a level where they're being brought on a national scale or to the Supreme Court or anything of that nature yet, because they're pretty much being resolved at the state level at the moment, and I don't think the Supreme Court wants to touch this yet, because it is a very, very dicey area when you've got people who are related, people who are not related, people who have given birth, people who are simply the surrogates, or versus people who are genetically related. It does get very interesting and very, very tricky, and that has caused a lot of concern in the endocrine community, in the reproductive endocrine community, as well as you mentioned the ethics community, because of the fact that we are entering into an age where so many women are undergoing assisted reproductive techniques, that what is the genetic makeup of our population going to be, you know, several generations down the road, if we have women who are donating large amounts of eggs and they have 100 offspring, and the same thing with the sperm donations. 100 offspring running around the country.
Who could potentially meet each other and marry.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, this is something that's very, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's not funny. I mean, when I was in medical school and all the women would see these posters, we'd all look at each other and say, okay, so if each of us donated 10 eggs to get $100,000, then what if those 10 eggs met up with, you know, 10 other medical students? So our 10 people, what if they met up with 10 other medical students' sperms, and all of the kids ended up being, you know, mating with each other, and then they're mating with their brothers and their sisters, and they don't know it.
Yeah, it sounds like sort of a wild Star Trek episode.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly when you're under stress in school, you know, you can come up with all kinds of wild scenarios, but it was a very real scare for us that women and men are doing this across the country, and I'm not sure. The trends are they're trying to do better genetic tracking so that this eventuality does not happen, but I just don't see it as being as well controlled as it could be or should be, or, you know, who knows. I don't I don't think it's happening. I don't think you get a genetic marker with your sperm donor that says, hi, you know, this sperm donor has this genetic code, so make sure they don't meet up with anybody that has that in the future. Are we going to do genetic testing of every couple that then comes to the church to get married and say, sorry, you guys can't get married, your brother and sister, and you didn't know it?
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, are there ethical limits from your perspective? I mean, if you're doing a lot of the hormone manipulation and a woman who is clearly postmenopausal wants to have a baby, which is happening all over the place, we keep seeing stories about this, would you have hesitation to stimulate her into a state where she could actually conceive?
I would have huge problems with that, and most reproductive endocrinologists also have ethical dilemmas in doing so, and most of them that I've spoken with, somewhere in the early 40s is their cutoff. I believe 42 to 44, roughly around there, maybe even 45, pretty much 45 on the outside is considered the cutoff that is acceptable. And
really, 45 is considered the cutoff? Because I would say that almost sounds a little young.
Well,
you pushed it so far that I don't even know anymore.
Well, I think that's exactly part of the problem, is we think of 45 as young because our life expectancy is expanding, but our reproductive expectancy is not expanding. And so the problem is that, you know, there are women out there who, as I was telling you during one of the breaks, I have a 44-year-old patient who wanted to do this, and she couldn't find any reproductive endocrinologist to do it. Because ethically speaking, they are bound by a code and they have an absolute cutoff, but there are obviously those who will do anybody. And I think that those people are certainly exceeding the ethical bounds that have been created by our societies, our medical societies. And I know that once my patients hit the early 40s, if they're asking me for assisted reproductive techniques, we go into a very detailed counseling session about realistic expectations based on their overall health, based on their spouse's or sperm donor's health if they're going to be involved in parenting. Because, you know, as you know, having a child is not like buying a car. You can't just get rid of it when you're tired of it.
And I would argue that some people go into these decisions where they spend more time thinking about buying a car.
Yeah. Right.
We're going to have to end this discussion, but thank you so much for being on. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Elena Christofides. You can find her online at endocrinology-associates.com. For more information about today's topic, check out my book, The Fertility Sourcebook, Third Edition, available on Amazon or at your public library. Dr. Christofides will be back March 16th to talk about premature menopause, which picks up on where we just left off. And next week, we devote our show to the topic of drug-free ways to cope with musculoskeletal pain and injury with a doctor of natural medicine, Michelle Shoffro-Cook, author of Healing Injuries, The Natural Way. You can visit me online at sarahhealth.com. And remember, you are not alone.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to Sarah Health Radio. To contact Dr. Rosenthal or one of her guests for more information, visit sarahhealth.com. Tune in next Thursday for another hour of Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal.